By Jove. What is that? Emerging from the haze. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it a race for a postseason spot?
Perhaps it is, thanks to the Mets of New York, and we are going to talk about that and more on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbercast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world who actually, you know, I don't need to meet the Mets. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And that seems like it would take a long time.
Yeah, that's fair. Do you have a similar feeling about whether you would like to greet the Mets? I guess those kind of go hand in hand.
So I would say that greeting the Mets would be more of a chore than meeting the Mets. Because If you're to meet the Mets, hi, I'm Jake. Hi, I'm Garrett.
I'm Mark Vientos. Yep. Okay. Right? So that's easy. That part's easy.
Greeting the Mets feels like I'm hosting the Mets.
Right.
Where They're coming to my house. Hello. Welcome to my apartment. Please take your shoes off, Jeff McNeil. He wouldn't. He seems like the type of guy who keeps his shoes on your carpet. No. But we're not here to disparage the Nueva York Metsies because they are the hottest team in the Major League Baseball League. Seven in a row. Is there anything Jewier than the Mets winning seven games in a row? Like seven biblical?
Oh, right? That's true. Maybe if they can extend it to another Sabbath victory this weekend. I am very excited about this Mets run. The timing of this Mets run, the sequencing of this Mets run, while I think when we talked about it earlier this week, it was like, oh, watch out. And remember that series with the Mets and Red Sox, two teams we had been kind of comparing all season as in similar positions in their respective leagues. We were going to get some clarity here. And the Mets were going in the right direction and the Red Sox were going in the wrong direction even before this series. And that continued to an extreme degree as the Mets sweep Boston. Boston, who we'll touch on briefly, is in a bad spot. They are now behind Detroit, behind Seattle. But the Mets are not just chasing down the Braves and the Padres and the Diamondbacks now. They are right there with them. They have the same record on this Friday morning as the Braves of Atlanta with that seven-game winning streak and the Braves getting dominated by Austin Gomber last night. And now we have something that is very compelling here. And I think the way I want to look at the situation is kind of the stakes involved and how we're going to talk about the Mets and the Braves and I guess the Diamondbacks and Padres over these next couple weeks, because you know the Padres still sit three games ahead of the Braves. They had a heartbreaking loss last night. Parker Meadows go ahead grand slam on 3-2, two out pitch from Robert Suarez. The Diamondbacks got walked off by the Giants yesterday. They're 2.5 up from Atlanta, New York. So these teams might end, and we've talked about how we kind of feel like the Dodgers might start to pull away here. All of these teams are interesting, but let's keep it focused on the Mets and the Braves because those are the two teams that are currently tied here. For the Mets in particular, we've had a lot of conversations about what the expectations were for them coming into this season, whether it was reasonable to expect them to compete for a postseason spot, and sort of the mixed messages that their leadership were giving us regarding what we were really supposed to be hoping and expecting from them this season. So now that we're here, and there are only 20-odd some games left, and they're tied for a postseason spot, and they have a real chance, how much should we really be expecting from them? Should we be now holding them to a higher standard? Is this a feel-good story? Yes, it is. Of course, there's a lot of good vibes with them. This is still also a team with $300 million payroll that plays in New York. And so that's where I'm kind of find this interesting. It's like, how are we going to really talk about the Mets over these next few weeks?
So it's important to remember, they did not go for it at the deadline at all. They went full half measure. They traded for Paul Blackburn, who I believe is now hurt.
Yes.
They traded for Ryan Stanek, who has been fine.
Yep. And they traded for Jesse Winker, who is finally hitting pretty well. I would say that is the one move. Now, again, I don't think offense was really the thing where it was like, oh my gosh, what are they going to do without adding a Jesse Winker type? So in that
Jordan,
sense,
it's not Jordan. Yeah. Jordan. It's not, oh my gosh. It's sorry.
Oh my God. We really, really need Jesse Winker, but in Spanish. That's true. Thank you. Good correction there. Good edit.
You can't say, oh my gosh, when discussing the Mets. I mean, that's heresy.
Right. I mean, we got Kenley Jansen singing the song before his team gets swept. So what am I? Of course. I mean, this is the song of the summer, as we know. But Jesse Winker has started. I mean, it was not a good start there in August, but he's been hitting really well. So he's certainly been helping. But to your point, it was not a this is the team. You know, we're really building this team to go and win a championship. That is not what happened.
I think this team, from a narrative storyline perspective, I really hope they make the playoffs because they have had incredibly memorable things happen to them. And when we look back at seasons, I want seasons that have these touch points to be teams that make the playoffs and are relevant and are, you know, involved. I would say there are three things that stick out in my head this year for the Mets. There's Jorge Lopez throwing the glove. Remember,
okay. That's true.
Jorge Lopez threw his glove into the stands. It was wild. Okay,
that's true. Obviously, that moment stood out for a lot of reasons that created discourse for better or for worse. Of course, we don't have to revisit that. But when we are thinking about the Mets season, if we're talking about, oh, if they do make the postseason, the low point, that was certainly a low point where it was like, oh, here we go again.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it was just so Metsy Mets. You could foresee a scenario where they win 75 games and we remember, well, that was the Jorge Lopez season. But then Grimace appears, mm-hmm. right, and turns the whole thing around. The McDonald's mascot throwing out the first pitch, the big purple god, and the Mets get hot. And then, of course, it is Candelita, OMG. Those three stories are fitting a postseason team. The idea that that narrative development could lead to a team that is not in it, that would be a missed opportunity. That would be a bummer from someone who cares about this world in a storytelling way.
The two other big ones that I think we have to mention, one has been in the news and we've talked about on the podcast, is obviously Lindor, right? This is the Lindor, you know, I am the Mets. So, I mean, whatever. Is he the NL MVP? Is he not? Whatever. I'm one of the best players in baseball. I am going to lead this team that maybe wasn't expected to be in the postseason for sure. Because I am one of the best players in baseball, I am allowing this to, or being a huge part of this happening. And so Lindor as a character is also, even though we've seen him with the Mets for a while, him being the main character on the Mets is in some ways weirdly kind of new. And I think that is also cool. I think that's a big part of this story as well. But then the other part of it is still Pete. And Pete's not one that we've really talked about, I feel like, that much, because once we realized he wasn't going to get traded at that point, we still weren't really sure how realistic it was for the Mets to make any noise. But now that we're here, now you zoom all the way a little bit farther out and you start to realize the stakes involved, because now you're looking at a roster because of how they've built it and because they went, especially on the pitching side, went for a lot of these short-term solutions. You're looking at a team that could look very, very different next year. And so in that sense, it has me thinking about this group. I mean, it obviously doesn't make any sense to call it a last dance because most of these guys are on the team for the first time. But it is a group that could look very different next year and is going to give the front office a lot of work to do. Of course, Pete's a big part of that. But JD Martinez is a big part of that, right? Luis Severino is a huge part of that. Like, there are a lot of characters here that are not necessarily going to be involved next year, but have clearly embraced what it is to be a Met. And so that, as this, the Mets de facto becoming this kind of lovable team, this underdog who I think a lot of neutrals will be cheering for over the Braves. I think that's pretty safe to say. That also makes them, I think, very compelling.
Well, and with the expectations, there's a house money element to how they're carrying themselves, at least especially recently.
Which is funny because it's also a money element.
Money. Yeah. The house has a lot of money.
Yes. Yes. But I
let's compare that to Atlanta. I mean, we've talked a lot about Atlanta season.
Sure.
It's, again, we've said this before, we'll say it again. They lost 2 6-win players pretty much early on in the season. Strider, I think, made 2 starts, and Acuna was meh for a month and a half, and then he tore his other ACL. If they have those 2 players at even half of their capabilities, they are easily a wild card team. Like, they're not even sweating. Can we agree on that?
I mean, I feel pretty good about that. Yeah.
And then when you add on to that, they were missing Michael Harris for 2 months. Austin Riley was hurt for a month, and now he's back on the IL. They haven't had Ozzie Albies for a while.
Yeah.
No team this year in baseball has had more important players go down with injuries than the Braves. However, because of the way that that roster is built, where there are so many good, talented players entrenched at positions, there were not a lot of opportunities for like roster maneuverability to have players that have had experience come in and fill those roles. That is something you see a lot on teams like, you know, Milwaukee or Tampa when they're good, where it's like, oh, that guy's played a little bit. This guy gets hurt. Give him a bigger role. The Orioles are actually a good example this year, right? Where, you know, because they were doing so many platoons with, you know, Ryan Mountcastle and Ryan O'Hearn, Mountcastle goes down, O'Hearn just gets more time, and it's not a huge fall off. And I'm not saying that, like, the Braves shouldn't have uncovered and developed these phenomenal players and extended them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you do that every time. But what I'm saying is there is a what's the opposite of a silver lining? Like a like a poop lining, you know, like a crap lining to that type of roster building strategy. And we have seen the downside of it. Now, still, the Braves should make the playoffs over the Mets. Even still,
yeah, still a right? better, like they, still a better roster,
still a better pitching. Roster.
Yeah,
the pitching, the Braves pitching. If they get in, that's a formidable group. Chris Sale is going to win the Cy Young. Max Fried is one of the lowest ERAs over the last 5 years. Reynaldo Lopez, I know he was a little worse last night, a little worse. I think he allowed 2 runs. Woo-hoo.
Right,
right,
yeah.
And Schwellenbach, rookie, sublime.
Awesome.
And so, like that quartet. Is just so much better than what the Mets have.
Oh my God, the bullpen, right? I mean, even if you grant a good version of Edwin Diaz, Raisel Iglesias has been a top five closer this year.
He's been better.
And he's been better. And they have a lot of other really good arms. So they have that advantage, and they still have some impact bats, especially with Olsen still playing. But all that said, like the thing I keep going back to is we always start with, okay, well, they lost these 2 6-1 players. The thing is that the average fan's not crying for the Braves no matter what, right?
Of course. I get it.
Now, it still seems weird that they
but
would
But that's what happens.
Yeah.
That's what success does, right? Like when you win 6 of these in a row, neutrals don't pull for you. Mm-hmm. Remember how much everyone was sick of the Phillies in 2012 and now, you know, the last few seasons including us. We used to say on the show, remember what we used to say?
Yeah.
We treat all 29 teams equally, but F the Phillies.
Yeah. Like you know? That in our earliest podcast, that's how we felt because of how tired we were of them just running the National League. And then they got very, very bad basically immediately. And then it was a while and now we're back, you know, circle of life. Here they are again at the top of the National League. But that is what is interesting about kind of these two teams from a narrative standpoint. Now, if you look ahead and you look at, okay, what is the likelihood that the Mets can actually pull this off? Their challenge is the schedule is much harder for the Mets when you compare. They have 7 more games against the Phillies. Now, the Phillies, and the Phillies will be playing for stuff. They're playing for the 1 seed. They're playing for the bye, all these things, right? So it's not like even if the Phillies have the division locked up, they're necessarily going to roll over against the Mets, and that's still a rivalry too. So that's certainly compelling. Braves' schedule is a little bit easier, but we're all already looking ahead. That final week, the Mets will be in Atlanta for those 3 games, and at the very least as neutrals, we can hope that they are, if not tied, at least, you know, within a couple of games going into that series.
I'm doing a clickety-clacketing to see if Chris Sale is lined up to pitch in that series. Because one of the more interesting things of, you know, the Phillies and Braves played 7 games in a span of 13 days, and Chris Sale did not pitch once because he just was not on schedule.
Right.
And the Braves were like, well, you know, come on. You're not going to reshuffle it for that,
but
come on. So, yeah, Sale is set to pitch Sunday the 8th, the day of my wedding. Thank you, Chris, for contributing to the wedding registry.
Oh, yeah. We'll see. I mean, he certainly has the funds to do so.
So he's pitching on Sunday the 8th. That means he would pitch Friday the 13th. Woo!
Okay. Spooky. Hopefully stay healthy, Chris. Yep.
Wednesday the 18th. And that would have him...
That would be
set
pretty
to pitch the opener against the Mets, I think.
Okay.
He will pitch in that Mets series.
It lines up pretty well. It lines up pretty well if everything stays together. So that would be delightful. And yeah, I mean, that's the thing with this Mets team. I've certainly enjoyed watching them. We certainly know our fair share of Mets fans. But I am just really curious about how we're going to talk about Pete in particular if they get to the postseason, Pete goes on this huge run, and now there's even more pressure. Like, all these things, I just find him as an interesting character, because honestly, Lindor has rightfully gotten all the attention, and that's totally fine. But Pete's someone I'm really curious about.
One last name we need to mention in this conversation before we take a break, and that is Carlos Mendoza, the Mets manager. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Jordan and I think our take on managers is that, well, first of all, it's just so hard to tell who's good at this, right? There is no stat line for this. If you took the best manager in baseball and gave them the White Sox, they wouldn't be very good. And if you gave Pedro Grifol, who was fired from the White Sox job, the Dodgers, they would probably be in the hunt still, yeah. Right? And yeah. So that just makes it very difficult to evaluate managers. Great example, Skip Schumacher. Mm-hmm. Year ago, he won the NL Manager of the Year award with the Marlins.
Yeah.
He hasn't gotten worse at the job.
No. And another one, right? We have sequences like what's gone on with Milwaukee, right? And Chicago. And I know the Cubs are kind of fighting their way back into it, but it's like, what am I supposed to make of that? You know, the Cubs give Craig Counsell the most money anyone's ever given a manager, and the Brewers are like, that's fine. We'll just take the guy that was Craig Counsell's college coach, and he'll just, you know, win manager of the year anyway. It's like, okay, sure. What is this? What am I learning about that? Is it all about the front offices? Is it more about the front offices? Probably, right? Based on a lot of these examples, it's based on the roster. But all that said, Mendoza as a first timer, I've thought about this a lot with Vogt, right? Stephen Vogt in Cleveland this year is first timer. We talk about first time managers. And that's really a lot of why this discourse is both hard, but also interesting.
Mendoza is good at the job. He is good at the job. Is he the 7-win difference? I don't know, right? He is good at the job. And there are times when we get a first-year manager and it becomes clear pretty quickly that either they are not good at the job or that we don't yet know if they are good at the job. And being around the Mets and talking to people with the Mets, the overwhelming energy is that Mendoza is a serious person who is good at the job.
Yeah. But again, there's more examples, and I trust you, especially to your point, you're around the team a lot. Matt Quatraro. I mean, they hire him last year. They lose the franchise record 106 games. They weren't supposed to be good, right? But now they're good. Now they're going for the postseason. And it's like, I mean, I assume he has something to do with that. But they also got a lot more good baseball players. So I don't know.
But there's also, I think, managing in Kansas City, not to take anything away from Quatraro, but managing in Kansas City and managing in Queens is just a different job in a lot of ways where...
100%.
I mean, the Yankees job is just completely different than all the other jobs. Like Aaron Boone is doing a different gig. And that is why I don't think they will fire him this year, because he knows how to do it. And it's very hard to know how to do. But Mendoza navigating like the Jorge Lopez thing and where the Mets were as a team at that point and inspiring confidence in a clubhouse that did not significantly reinforce itself at the deadline. When a front office acts a certain way at the trade deadline, that sends a message to the team. And the message that that David Stearns and crew made to the team was, we kind of believe in you. And yet Mendoza was somehow able to maintain the momentum down the stretch here. And so I think that I have been very impressed with him, being around him, talking with him. He understands the role of that specific job. I think being under Aaron Boone across town in New York
can't hurt.
Is very good work experience for him. And I just think he deserves a lot of the credit, because it's not necessarily always the decisions you make as a manager. It is how you choose to make those decisions.
Yeah.
I don't really care if you pinch hit or you pull a guy, or just have conviction. Have conviction in your decision making.
Yeah.
And I think that when you compare that, I like Brian Snitker. I think he's good. He recently, especially when it comes to bullpen stuff, has not been particularly convicted in his decision making and his explanation of those decisions afterwards.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was the last thing about Mendoza I wanted to hit. This Mets bullpen is still undermanned. And
there's so much Jose Buto.
Yeah, and which that's your guy.
That's my guy, Joey Butts.
Yeah. But I just, that's another thing as we head into a postseason race, whether they get there or not. Now the actual managerial decisions are going to start to become a lot more scrutinized. But with that is still who's on the team. And I'm looking at the guys that he can turn to and I'm just like, I guess I could be mad. Like, why is he going to him? But it's like, oh, well, it's, whereas again, when you compare it to the Braves, it's like, well, they got a lot of good options. So it probably is the right way to deploy them.
As I sit here in the backyard of my parents' home, that brings up an analogy in my head, which is a teenage Jordan Schusterman walking into my parents' house, opening the refrigerator and the snack cabinet and being incredibly underwhelmed by what's in there. Mm. One cannot critique Jordan for his selection between the mediocre substandard snacks that my family consistently
Who supplied the snack? That was just not, we had different expectations.
Never the snack house. Never the snack house.
Eventually, right. I learned that, and eventually, but again, Mendoza doesn't have a choice. Now, it is funny in this case, right? Because, like, the Mets having this, like, star-studded offense, where, like, everyone's making $15 million or more, and then this bullpen's just like, Edwin Diaz and some friends. So, anyway, that's another part about it. It's just, like, how we talk about Mendoza. Let's just remember what he is working with here. I'm going to get to the Red Sox later on for the bad portion of Good, Bad, and Ugly. Anything else from this week? Listen, the Cubs threw a combined no-no. That's awesome. I mean, really, it would have been a lot more awesome had they not completely embarrassed themselves against the Pirates the previous two nights, because then we'd be talking about them, perhaps, in this conversation with the National League postseason race. And maybe they'll still get in there. Obviously, it's still a pretty weak schedule, but they have the Yankees coming to town, and they've got Yankees and Dodgers back-to-back series. So, as we said, after losing the series to the Pirates, they're going to have to play a little bit better over the next week than we maybe even originally thought. So that's the pressure on the Cubs.
Two quick hitters. Astros got swept by the Reds, and it doesn't matter really because the Mariners only split against Oakland.
Yes.
And so they didn't make up too much ground. Mm-hmm. Seattle's still 4.5 back. Mm-hmm. I need to watch a lot of those Astros games back. I don't know what happened.
Their offense just kind of went to sleep. Rhett Lauder was very good yesterday. Ty France is helping the Mariners as a Red. He's been hitting very well.
Amazing.
For Cincinnati. So that's kind of cool to see.
And then the other one is the Phillies are now on a W5, and they've created some separation between them and the Brewers for that bye.
Well, and then, but aren't the, but they're tied with the Dodgers. So
correct.
I for the bye though. Yes. So for the bye, so not for the one seed. Yes. That is a good point. All right. We are going to take a quick break. And when we return, we got some news, some guys that are sticking around, Matt Chapman and Jerry DePoto. We'll be right back.
Now, if there's one thing we know to be true, it is that super agent Scott Boras does not sign extensions. He doesn't do that, okay? It's like a bar that doesn't play a certain song, or like how my dad doesn't eat halva, right? Or Jordan doesn't
just
like seafood, you know?
Now we're talking.
Are certain things that certain people, they just don't do.
Yeah.
But this week, we saw Scott Boras zag. He signs an extension for his client, Matt Chapman, of the San Francisco Giants, a 6-year, $150 million extension to keep Chapman in the Bay for a long, long time.
Let's go back to that analogy of me liking or disliking seafood, because I think the thing to consider here is the new context of Scott Boras, the agent. Now, this could change this winter when he perhaps signs, I don't know, another like $1.5 billion worth of contracts with Burns and Soto and Pete and Bregman. And we'll get to all those guys. However, after what happened this past offseason, we know Jordan Montgomery already said, peace, I'm not messing with this anymore. This is an example of Matt Chapman, another guy who ended up with a much smaller contract than we expected, being like, wait a minute, I'm the client. and I am playing very well, and I am not messing around with an open market anymore. We always like to say, oh, you got to see what you have in the open market. And he's like, you know what? I like it here, and the Giants have a ton of money that they want to give me. They already wanted to give it to me, and they still want to give it to me. And so, sure, is there a chance I could go out there and keep, if I play the way I have been the rest of the season, and I reach the open market, and everyone remembers that I'm really good, and I'm Matt Chapman, and my defense is back to being awesome, and all these things, maybe I'll get $200 million. But instead, Matt Chapman's like, listen, Scott, we're not doing that again. Let's just lock in $150 million because it's right there in front of us, and let's just move on. And Scott Boras is probably looking at it as like, great, I got him a lot of money that he didn't get last offseason under with me, but you know, I got him a bunch of money guaranteed. There you go. We're great. And so the reason I bring up the seafood analogy again is because, like, I don't really see that changing. I'm not really sure what would have to happen for me to suddenly start, like, you know, smashing down a bunch of oysters. Like, that seems unlikely. However, yeah. In Scott Boras' case, some things have changed and that have maybe impacted the way he handles some of these situations. So we'll see.
It is. He works for Matt Chapman.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, and we have to remind everyone ourselves that, and yeah,
that's really that simple. As far as this goes for the Giants, kind of an interesting move. Chapman has been very good this year.
Yeah, really,
very, very good, very good. And I still think he is a particularly volatile player in some ways, particularly on the offensive side. Strikes out a lot, but boy, when he hits that ball goes, baby.
And he's got his lowest strikeout rate in 5 years. And obviously he's always hit the ball really hard. But he's been a little bit more consistent, and the defense has gotten back to a near elite level where that is a player when you have the payroll that the Giants have and still some more flexibility coming up. Like, yeah, just lock in, say there's our third baseman. We don't have to think about this anymore. There is some obvious comfort in that. Now, as we know, based on the fact that they are probably going to finish at or around 500 again, there's a lot more work to be done here, but this is a nice thing that they don't have to think about this winter.
Under 500, are you aware they have by far the hardest schedule remaining? I don't know where the Giants are in the standings right now. It probably is not particularly close. Oh, they're 7.5 back. Well, guess what, Jordan? They have 3 against Milwaukee, Baltimore, Arizona, Kansas City, St. Louis, and 6 against San Diego. They like do not play a team under 500 the rest of the way.
Yeah, so that's going to be hard. And again, for all the money, all they spent this past offseason on Chapman, and that went well, and Snell wasn't going well and sort of worked out. 81 wins in 22, 79 wins last year. And I think it'd only be right if they finish with 80 in 2024. But yeah, I think Matt Chapman's really good. And it's kind of, again, extensions like this where it's just kind of going well in the team. It's not that complicated. It's good for him. I'm glad he got his money. He probably deserved it last year. And he'll just now be the Giants' third baseman. We'll see if they can get enough other good players around him.
And congratulations to Alex Bregman, who will be a free agent this winter and now has a baseline from which to work. You will not receive less than this.
And to that point, that's another part of the Boras angle is Scott's like, you know, he's had examples where it's like, I got multiple of the same position, but he's like, oh no, this is great because now I just can focus on this guy as my third baseman that I am selling to people. So I think that definitely makes sense. So Bregman in a good spot. All right, let's stick with guys that are not going anywhere. According to some reporting from friends of the show, Ryan Divish and Adam Jude of the Seattle Times, Gerard DePoto, Jerry D himself, Trader Jerry.
Or as your brother used to call him.
DePoto.
Jerry DePoto.
DePoto. Jerry DePoto, who has been head of Mariners baseball operations since September of 2015, will continue on, according to the reporting from the Seattle Times, as the head of the Mariners baseball operations for at least another season. Now, after they fired Scott Service, we sort of already had a sense this was the direction the organization was going to go. Things only got worse after they fired Scott Service. Got a little bit better and then a little bit worse. Now they are, as we mentioned, only 4.5 back from Houston, but their playoff odds are now below 10%. I think this is not a shocking decision, but I think the main takeaway here is this is a bet that the things that he is doing well, which are under his leadership, they have obviously developed an elite rotation, and they have restocked the farm system consistently over and over. This was a team that was basically at the bottom of farm system rankings for years. And now, even when they've graduated a bunch, have already, because of how well they've drafted, launched it back up to, you know, a top 10 system. When we talk about all the Mariners' flaws offensively, I think that this is, now this isn't going to make the rest of the season any more pleasant, because I still expect them to come short, and they still are going to have a lot to fix this winter that they cannot fix internally. However, this really does seem to be a bet on this next wave of mostly hitters probably getting to the big leagues sooner than we expect, because those are the guys, if we really are going to find out whether they are good or truly terrible, as bad as it gets at developing hitters, it's the now up to whatever eight top 100 prospects that they have. A lot of these hitters at all positions, outfielders, first basemen, infield, shortstops, catchers, all these guys that have slowly rise to the minors, that every, all the prospect people think all these guys are awesome. Those guys really better start hitting, and those guys better get to the big leagues by the end of next year or ready for 2026, because otherwise it's just not good enough. That's the bet here. And it's also a sign that the ownership does not want to bother to go through an actual upheaval of both the entire coaching staff and obviously the entire front office. So they are going with continuity. You can criticize that for sure. I think that I completely understand if you're looking at this after 10 years, they made the postseason one time and say, it's not good enough, we got to go in a different direction. That's totally valid. I can't really dispute that. But he has done just enough right that he's going to get one more chance here. But based on how the rest of the season goes, man, like I said, postseason or not, if they finish at or below 500 after being averaging 90 wins the last three seasons, that's just going to make this offseason all the more difficult. And the messaging is going to have to change, because they can't just say, oh, we came up just short. It's like, no. You just like weren't even very good. And that is what is going to be really difficult for this team, optics-wise, to really get over this winter, basically no matter what happens, barring a total miraculous run to the playoffs.
Every baseball executive head honcho needs to be evaluated within the constraints placed upon them by the ownership group, right? So if Jerry Dipoto was allowed to spend, like Andrew Friedman in L.A., or like Brian Cashman in New York, I think the roster would be better, and I think that the conversation about Dipoto would be different. Now, what is frustrating about Dipoto specifically is his comments last offseason about winning 54% of games. It's not exactly the way to get your fan base going. And Dipoto is the type of executive who fits within the context of his environment, where like he is, stay the course, don't panic, ride it out. I want to see how Jerry Dipoto on the hot seat operates. Because while you don't want your president of baseball operations operating with panic or mania, a little urgency, I think, goes a long way.
Yeah.
And I, particularly in assembling the Mariners offensive group, he has rarely shown urgency or a willingness to significantly upgrade certain elements of the roster. Now, trading for Randy at the deadline this year, that's a big plus in his column. Like, that's the type of move that a team with a pitching staff this good should have been making for a long time. I know Jerry transacts quite a bit, but a lot of it is just shuffling the lounge chairs on the Titanic.
Yep.
And I think I want to see him act with his foot on the gas a little bit more, and maybe a season like this will inspire him to do that.
Yeah, and it just becomes hard, because I think your point about ownership is spot on, but it's also, it's like, it's not even, it's almost more subtle than that, right? Because it's moves like salary dumping Eugenio Suarez, you know? I mean, if they had him at third base this year with what he's been for Arizona, they'd be in a better spot. And they decided, oh, we're gonna get creative. We're going to do it with Josh Rojas and Luis Urias. It's like, all right, well, but you could also just have a regular third baseman making a normal amount of money. You know, it's stuff like that. And there's all kinds of moves that they've made because of that. Not necessarily because they're not willing to spend. But to your point, too, yes, they have made some aggressive maneuvers, but a lot of them just haven't worked. You know, and so that's ultimately why I think fans are done waiting, is because he has made a ton of moves. And more of them on the offensive side have fallen short than actually, you know, reached expectations. So I think that's what he's going to be judged by. But I do agree with you, especially if they finish around 500. They can't pretend like they are right there with Houston anymore, because I mean, I guess they can. Like, it's so weird to say, like, yeah, you're 10 games up on them, but that had more to do with Houston's problems than you actually playing very well. But you can't pretend like you're right up there with them. Like, no, they just embarrassed you over the last few months of the season. For the last few years, you could say, oh, right there, just a couple moves. Can't say that anymore. You can't. Yep. You just cannot pretend that. I mean, I even believed it, right? After the 2022, with what the pitching was coming, I was like, yeah, they should be able to compete with them. And I guess for a couple months they did. But no, you can't say that with a straight face. So we'll see how these last few weeks shake out, whether it makes any difference. It clearly doesn't make any difference for his job security. But that's kind of where I'm at on Jerry D. And, you know, the DePoto tracker lives, baby. He's made 175 trades as Mariners Pobo GM. And we'll see if he can get to 200 before he gets canned.
All right. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll do the good, the bad, and the ugly. Welcome back to the End of Baseball Barbacast. I have not been working much this week because I am about to do nuptials. Jordan Schuster, however.
All right.
Do love the nuptials. Hey, English gives us the opportunity to twist a pretzel, and I shall. Jordan, however, you have been clicking those keys, and you produced quite a lengthy and enjoyable read about Guardians closer Emmanuel Clase, who is likely to finish in the top five of AL Cy Young voting this year. He is the best closer in baseball right now. You live near Cleveland, close enough, and you talked to Emmanuel for this long story you wrote. Tell me about the story and the process of putting it together.
I've been in this area for a couple months now, and the Guardians, obviously a relevant team, and I wanted to... You know, I've written about them a little bit, but I was thinking, okay, well, what's this bullpen? Okay, Kwan, Ramirez, and of course, as they head towards the postseason, I'm sure I'll be writing about them plenty more, and it's good to watch this team on a daily basis, get to know Vogt, all these guys. But then I was like, I kind of woke up a couple weeks ago, I was like, wait a minute, they have this 26-year-old who's already, you know, saved 140 games or whatever in his career. It's right here. I mean, we are witnessing a historic beginning to a career and someone who is doing it different than everybody else. And I think that's really, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. I mean, if you can say he's chasing the lowest ERA we've ever seen from a reliever. I mean, the margins for error there are very small because when your ERA is under 0.8, you know, every run you allow is a huge deal. So we'll see if he can actually chase down quote unquote Zach Britton. But he's just been completely overwhelming. And the fact that he could be so good for 3 years and then somehow get better is really the story that I wanted to tell. And the fact that there are versions of this across the league where when you see them for long enough, you're like, oh, that's their thing. We're just used to it. But we should not just pretend like his 102 mile an hour cutter is normal because it's not. It was not a pitch we had ever seen before he arrived. And while, yes, you know, I write about the ties, of course, he grows up loving Pedro Martinez and he turns his attention to Mariano Rivera when he becomes a closer. We've seen, you know, Kenley Jansen, right, has hundreds of saves with the cutter. David Robertson did it right after Mariano Rivera, but those guys weren't throwing it at 100. And when you combine throwing on 100 mile an hour cutter with, I mean, essentially elite command, it just doesn't exist. Everyone else that throws 100 is spraying it. And the only other guy that really is throwing 100 consistently that is throwing anywhere close to as many strikes as him is Robert Suarez this year. And his fastball, which he's throwing also 80% of the time, is not quite good enough to, as we saw last night, to still be unhittable every time. But the fact that Clase is now throwing more cutters than ever, the fact that he doesn't walk anybody, the fact that he's now controlling the running game, he's automatic. And he really is something to behold. And while he doesn't have the strikeouts, and that's why you don't necessarily see him, you know, on Pitching Ninja quite as much, he's one of a kind. He is a singular talent, a singular arm talent. And it's really amazing what he's been able to accomplish.
My biggest takeaway reading your article is the reminder that dude is 26. just because he's been in our lives, our baseball lives now for a couple of years as an elite closer.
Yeah.
We forget that he's still younger than both of us by a lot. And
he
is just getting started, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. And that's the thing. The only closers, I guess I technically omitted mistakenly. Maybe I'll go back and Ben Joyce, I guess, is younger. Now, he obviously doesn't have that many saves yet. But other than him, it's like Munoz with the Mariners and Mason Miller. But other than that, this guy's younger than all these other guys, and he's already the franchise saves leader, which is amazing. The one that really blew my mind, and this really kind of elicits why he's so special, and this is the last thing I'll say, then we can move on. You guys can go read the long story if you want to read more, is he's younger than Doval. Like, he's Camilo Doval with the Giants is really the only other pitcher that throws a cutter like this on the planet. Again, we've seen Corbin Burns at his peak, maybe is throwing a cutter up there, but 100-mile-an-hour cutter, it's really just Doval. And his command is catastrophic, right? Now, he's still a late-inning guy because the stuff is that good, but Doval is like still, even his option this year, he's still like figuring it out, and he's racked up a lot of saves. He still has not quite solved it. Klaus is younger than him even by a couple months, and he's already an all-time great, you know, through age 26. And I'll say the last thing about this during the research for the story, and I barely touched on it. The real thing that I appreciated looking into this was not Mariano Rivera. It was Craig Kimbrell. And I know that because he's pitched for so long and had so many low moments in his 30s, maybe that'll be Class A one day. But the real, like, what Kimbrell did through age 26 was basically Class A, but with strikeouts. And we should not lose sight of that when we take Craig Kimbrell's career into totality, whenever that time comes. So anyway, if you want to read more about Class A, you can go check that out, obviously, up at Yahoo Sports. All right, Jake. It's time for the good, the bad, the ugly. It's Friday, and you're getting married in 2 days, so let's keep this quick. We will begin with some good. Would you like to begin?
Yeah. Ludicrous. Not the adjective.
But also the adjective.
Well, one in the same in some ways, but Ludicrous, the musician, actor, you know.
Yeah. There's a lot of things.
Showed up and threw out the first pitch at Truist Park this week with the big old freaking arms.
And shoes.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, please Google Ludicrous Get Back music video and sit back and enjoy. These are the arms are so big. And he threw the pitch with the big arms is really impressive. I think that you could have had the big arms without the big hands, but the big hands make him throwing the ball just outstanding. It's so good. We should have more wonky first pitches. I want more bits, more shticks.
Yes.
More, you know, playful theatrics for first pitches and ludicrous.
Hundreds of opportunities, right? And most of them, I know, someone in the community, you know, those people can still throw first pitches. Most teams are doing like three or four or five every game now. It's not like they're just doing one. So, yeah, more of these. I mean, Ludacris is fantastic. He's one of my favorite artists. And just as a character, this is a crossover I could certainly get behind. So I agree. This is definitely good. Also ugly, but definitely good. My good's a little bit more straightforward. Pablo Lopez has been incredible over the last month. He had three consecutive scoreless outings. He did allow three runs yesterday, but the Twins were able to split the opportunity in Tampa Bay. And he's thrown harder than ever. We saw Pablo Lopez's hardest fastball of his career yesterday, which is really something. But this is just good to see. That's why it's in good, because Pablo Lopez's ERA was over 5 as late as July 10th. And now it is creeping under 4 almost. So again, the Twins, we haven't had a lot of Twins chat. I think we'll see. I want them to this is the thing about the Twins. They've been so steady the whole season, but they've yet to really give us a reason to like, we have to talk about them. That has not happened really at any point this year. They've not fallen in the wrong direction, but they also haven't been like, here's our 8-game winning streak. Maybe that's coming, but Pablo Lopez looking like the Pablo Lopez we saw at the end of last year is really, really encouraging. And he's certainly one of my favorite pitchers. So he is good for me.
You know what's bad?
What's bad?
The Jason Dominguez homered again. I mean, that's not bad. Like, here's a good question. Producer Andrew, please put this in the chat. Are you happy that Jason Dominguez continues to rake in AAA? Like, it is clear that the Yankees have chosen Alex Verdugo for the rest of this season. They believe in this guy.
I still think we're going to see him. I still think we're going to see Jason, but continue.
But I would imagine there is probably a segment of Yankee fan who's like, you know, it would be good if Dominguez just stunk in AAA for the rest of the year so that, like, I don't even have to think about this.
Well, Yankees fan hearts in the chat says, love it. So I think at this point,
you know
Yankees
why?
Fans,
it's because Yankees fans, and this is many fans, but want to genuinely believe that they know more
100%,
about baseball 100%. Than the people making the decisions.
They and want so, the team to look silly.
Yes, there are reasons to be playing Verdugo and not Dominguez. I disagree with it. I think it's the wrong choice. I think it's a bad decision. But I just love that it's reaffirming the criticism in a way that, like, that to me is good. But the whole thing, if you're in Yankee world, is bad.
I will say the one Jason Dominguez thing, which has been pointed out, it is so bizarre that they called him up for the Little League game and bat him fifth and then sent him right back. That was so
doesn't make
weird.
Any sense.
That was so weird. Like, maybe he's the only one that makes sense, like, roster wise to call up. But then why is he starting and batting fifth? And so strange, so strange. So I still think we're going to see him at some point. But yeah, Jason Dominguez, he's I mean, we talk about Clase, but we've been talking about Dominguez forever, and he's still only 21.
Okay. Jason Dominguez, ALDS hits over under 1.5.
So that requires the Yankees to get to the ALDS.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going over.
Okay.
1.5 hits total in a DS postseason. A lot of play there. That's our kind of line. Again, we're not betting on baseball or sports, really. But that's a good way to think about these things. That's a great question.
Thank you.
Hearts in the chat. Hammer the over. Love that confidence.
That's coming from the same producer who, when I asked at the All-Star game, which Yankee would have the highest OPS plus the rest of the season, the third highest behind Judge and Soto. Mm-hmm. Producer Hart said Ben Rice.
Jordan, Ben Rice.
Who does Ben Rice play for right now?
He's with Jason in Scranton.
So you chalk that one up to an L. But if you... Okay, let's actually... Who's third? Is it Stanton? Is it Jazz?
Since then? No, I think it's been Wells. I think it's been Stanton. Heck, I think it's been Stanton. Well, Jazz, again, it's different because the number of plate appearances is a little different since the break, because he wasn't on the Yankees. But and he was hurt. Remember, Jazz is like hurt, but maybe he's not. Weird. Anyway, my bad this week. Don't worry, Yankees fans. Good news. The Red Sox. The Red Sox postseason odds have sunk to 7% after being swept in Queens. And sadly, this has included in a lot. Now, the bullpen continues to be an atrocity. But Rafael Devers is having probably the worst three-week stretch I've ever seen from him. He has just been basically the worst hitter in baseball since about the middle, third week of August. And that sucks because Rafael Devers is one of my favorite players, and he's just been kind of mopey and sad and hitting into double plays on the first pitch. That's like, oh man, that sequence just kills me. Is like big spot for a player that's struggling. They do the mound visit and it's like, all right, what an opportunity for redemption. I don't know the specific sequence, but it happened at some point during the series against the Mets. And it's like, all right, they do the beating for Devers and then just first pitch double play end of the inning. And just like, oh, this gets worse and worse. But yeah, man, I mean, the Red Sox are now, as I mentioned, behind Seattle, behind Detroit by a half game. They've lost 5 in a row. Their run differential has sunk to -5, but they're back at 500 where they belonged for much of the first 2 months. And I guess there's some comfort in that.
Netflix documentary is going to be pretty boring at the end.
So one of the Red Sox reporters was like, haven't seen the Netflix crew around much recently, which is maybe true, maybe just anecdotal. But I am very interested where this is going to go.
Well, it's football season. You know,
that's true. Those cameras are probably needed elsewhere. What's
Red Sox thing?
Oh, yeah.
Justice for Chaim Bloom. Okay.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, that's...
We're not just saying this because he's mishpucha. All right. but the man who built...
We're not saying it.
Look, but you want us to be unbiased?
Hey, we're not the only ones. Goys alike are tweeting about how good the Red Sox farm system is, and that's a lot because of Chaim Bloom.
Yeah. So, shouts out to Chaim Bloom.
Yeah.
My ugly.
What's your ugly?
So, you know, many players have charities, and they do charity events. Many of them involve wine, because rich people like wine. Corbin Burns has a charity, I think it's called Uncork for a Cause. Very nice. It's better than uncorking for...
Just to get schwasted.
Or like uncorking to do something terrible. You know, like uncorking to rob a bank.
Yeah, no. Much worse. For a cause. That could be the cause. For presumably a good cause. I'm assuming
a good cause.
Yeah.
Very nice. Now, the reason this is ugly is because Jackson Holliday went to this event. And Jackson Holliday is...
20.
And unless they were in Toronto on the road, Cloud Question, bro. Jackson Holliday's not old enough to drink the wine. Now, my question is this. I think I believe that Jackson Holliday has never boozed. Do you believe that?
Oh, okay. All right.
I think there's a chance that Holliday has not. I know he's married and like the oldest 20-year-old ever. But I think there's a chance he's like kind of a rule follower and whatever.
I mean, he hasn't had time to drink when he's been in the cage for the last 20 years.
Yeah. You can't.
And I'm can't only kind of joking.
Yeah. I mean, you can't uncork a Gruner Veltner when you're, you know, trying to hit against high speed.
Yeah, right. When you're in the shed that your dad built because he was an all-star outfielder.
You're not testing well-aged Barolo when you gotta work.
Keep that knowledge
on your
coming.
Hands.
I got no idea what words you're saying, but they sound good. Coming from the man about to get married at a winery, he's popping off.
Literally popping off. Anyway, it just Jackson Holliday showing up. Do you think I don't think Jackson Holliday consumed alcohol at this event. I should probably do some reporting on that.
That I feel confident about.
I don't think he was drinking at this event. But if he had tried to, okay, if he had like gone up to presumably the bar at the wine event and was like, G&T, please, what do you think would have happened? Because it's not like there were wristbands at this event, right? It's not
that's the thing. He
can I see your ID? Here's a wristband. No,
he was
like you're an adult.
Risk.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, it's like at a wedding, you know, there's the 16-year-old cousin like, hey, go grab me a glass.
Not a mine, baby.
He could do that. Now, but right. The question is like, does he have to ask Dean Kramer? Hey, Dean. Oh, Dean, can you? You know who it probably was? Probably Austin Slater. Every time I watch the Orioles, Jackson Holliday is sitting with Austin Slater. And I'm like, what a fascinating guy to be like.
This I would apologize
but,
to Austin
you know
Slater.
What? You know why that's perfect? You know why it's perfect? What could he learn from Austin Slater?
How to hit lefties.
Bingo. Jackson Holliday, let us know. Did you drink at this event? Actually, we know
did
people
you drink?
That were at this. We know people were at this event. We could probably find out.
Yeah.
All right.
The baseball bar guys does not support underage drinking. However, I think Jackson Holliday should. You know, okay, so like people will always say, "Oh, I don't like the drinking age being 21 because you can serve and die for your country, but you can't have a beer." Feels like if you reach the big leagues before 21, you get an exemption.
Oh,
right?
I'm a big leaguer.
I'm a big leaguer.
Can I see your ID?
Like,
but don't they have like a big league like ID?
They have the big league ID.
So that should count. I like that idea.
I look, if I'm elected president, my two rules.
Platform.
These are my two platforms, okay? When you turn 80, you have to take a driver's exam again. And
that's
two.
Then if you have an MLB ID, you're good.
MLB, if you're a big leaguer,
yep.
you can buy booze.
Great. I love that. My ugla is Aaron Judge on Paw Patrol. Now, people have noticed that Aaron Judge, who made a cameo on the Nickelodeon Junior show Paw Patrol, actually not even Paw Patrol. Paw Patrol now apparently is so big that this is a spinoff series called Rubble and Crew, which is an important detail because Aaron Judge appeared on Paw Patrol on August 26th on Rubble and Crew, the spinoff from Paw Patrol. Since then, he has hit 177 with zero home runs in 9 games, longest homerless stretch of his career. Not of his career, sorry, of the season, and probably of the last few seasons, but I'm not sure. That's funny in and of itself. Everyone is tweeting the same clip, like a 20-second clip where you see Aaron Judge in this show breaking his bat. But I just wanted, because I went back and watched the whole episode, because anytime baseball is represented in media is like, that's us. That's what we want to do. And I'm not talking about baseball movies. I'm talking about baseball where it's not supposed to be baseball. And then suddenly it's baseball. And Aaron Judge showing up on this Nickelodeon show is exactly that. And so I wanted to go find it. And I just wanted to share the premise because it's so funny. But did you have any questions
for it? Yeah. I have the summary in front of me on Wikipedia if you want to just read it.
Go ahead, and then I will fill in the gaps having actually watched it.
This is episode 23 of the season. It's called The Crew Builds a Ballpark. In the park, Coach Karima is playing baseball with Rubble and Crew, where Rubble hits a home run like Aaron Judge. Coach Karima mentions that he'll be partaking in a home run derby, where he'll be hitting 100 home runs, this is Judge, and will be stopping in Builder Cove to see his fans. Is it track for you, Jordan?
Yeah. No notes so far.
Judge arrives in Builder Cove, not Builder's Cove. That's actually...
No, it's just Builder Cove.
I don't really like that. Like, there's someone named Builder? Okay. Arrives in Builder Cove, where he has become familiar with Rubble and Crew. Speedmeister claims that Aaron Judge isn't great, as he plans to become the true baseball hero of Builder Cove. So there's like a bad guy, Speedmeister.
Speedmeister is the rival. So the premise of the show in general is a bunch of dogs are construction workers. I'm not kidding. And Speedmeister is the rival construction worker.
Is he a dog?
The villain. No, he's a dude. He's just a dude with a mustache. He kind of looks like kind of a 70s reliever.
Does he look like Waluigi?
Yeah, actually, he's a good amount. Yeah.
Okay. And does he have that dog in him?
Well, okay, we're going to get to that.
So Speedmeister, the rival construction crew, claims that Aaron Judge isn't great. Judge gets a call from his dogs, Penny and Gus.
His dogs FaceTime him. He gets his dogs. This seems to be what really got Judge to do this, is he loves his dogs. So he was like, oh, I'll go on Paw Patrol.
Penny and Gus. Are those actually his dogs' names?
Yeah. Okay. They're around.
Who inform him that the road to the home run derby has been closed.
Oh, no. Yes.
Aaron Judge is not driving to the home run derby.
No, but he gets off the bus, so he can't get there. He can't get to the ballpark. So what are they going to do?
To remedy this, Aaron Judge persuades Rubble and Crew to build a ballpark so that Judge can break the home run record. So they build a full stadium.
They just build a ballpark. They just, boom, in about 45 seconds, they just whip up the dogs. They whip up a ballpark specifically to host a home run derby where Aaron Judge is going to hit 100 home runs.
Speedmeister could freaking never, dude. What a bum. Public money involved in this ballpark?
That's unclear. I don't know who funded this.
If only it was this easy in Oakland.
Why? Why don't we just have Rubble and Crew just whip up?
Think about
the
how
nice
many
new
votes. Think
down
about all
on
the voting.
Howard Terminal. They could have made that happen.
Get Rubble and Crew down the Howard Terminal.
They made it look really easy. So anyway. Yeah. Okay. What
John next? Sherman, Royals owner, building that new downtown park in Kansas City. Called
it's
Rubble
gonna
and
have
Crew.
Like a ballpark village. There was no ballpark village. By the way, this is just a ballpark. There's really not a lot of like bells and whistles.
Forget populace. You know, Rubble and Crew, they're building yards. Once it's built, everyone attends the event as Speedmeister plans to strike Aaron Judge. Not strike out. That is a typo, I guess.
Or this is like a terrible AI summary, but continue. Okay, yeah, so basically Speedmeister, just so you know, he is the home run derby pitcher, and he does not have an L screen. He is just pitching to Aaron Judge and trying to prevent him from hitting a record 100 home runs. Now, it's unclear if the record is 99, who has the record, why. There's nobody else competing in the derby, by the way. It's just Aaron Judge in an empty ballpark, or not empty ballpark, but that's whatever. So just so you know,
it's
he's
not
pitching.
Game
it's not,
action.
No, and it's not like, oh, this is my coach. He's going to toss it in there. Like, Speedmeister's trying to get him out.
Okay. And he's hit 99 home runs off of Speedmeister.
Yeah, so he you know,
he's
in a groove, right? And by the way, the animation is like very compelling in the way that they mimic Judge's swing. And I'm not even joking. He's not wearing batting gloves, which is, that's not Aaron Judge. But he's using his lucky bat. He has his lucky bat that he's using.
Must have consulted Teacher Man on some of the mechanics. When Judge gets to 99 home runs, his lucky baseball bat breaks, causing rubble and crew to... He gets jammed. Does it go out, though?
It still goes out. The 99th home run, he gets jammed, bat shatters, ball still goes over the fence.
That happened to Barry Bonds. Never forget.
That's the clip that everyone has tweeted. But again, this is the context.
Rubble and crew make a new baseball bat, lucky baseball bat for Aaron Judge, so that he can get his 100th home run. So it's not luck. You can't make a new lucky thing.
Right. But they make, it's like a custom bat, kind of like a Players Weekend style. You know, it's got like a hard hat on it. It's very, very colorful. And Aaron Judge is like, thank you so much. And then Speedmeister at this point is gassed. I mean,
you gotta get someone up, dude.
Right. I mean, I know for now, there's no one else. And then he just absolutely torches one over the center field fence. Daytime fireworks. Continue, because there's a key detail here I want to make sure.
That's it.
It's over. Hits 100th home run. All you need to know is that after he hits the 100th home run, he rounds the bases. Again, do we need bases for a home run derby?
Probably so he not. Rounds, but he doesn't round it the 99 other times.
No, not that they didn't show that part. Okay. But on 100, gets 100. Boom, he does it. Whoa, yeah. Rounds the bases. Hits the gritty.
Whoa, he would never.
Crossing home. And I'm like, that ain't Aaron Judge. You lost me. I was so convinced it is him literally voicing. It looks like him. He's a big guy, whatever. And then I'm like, that wasn't very realistic.
No. The captain could not.
He would never. So that was a little showboaty from the captain. But Speedmeister, he got served there. And Aaron Judge hit 100 home runs. And then the dogs were elated. Penny and Gus were there. They showed up. And
if I'm Speedmeister's coach, I'm like telling the catcher, go talk to him.
Oh, the catcher, for some reason, is a turtle with a glove like... And again, it's unclear that it doesn't seem like the catcher needed to catch anything because Aaron Judge hit all the home runs every time Speedmeister threw a pitch. But
so Speedmeister had a 0% whiff rate?
Yeah, it was like... And unlike Clase, where that is okay, where you can make... His pitching to contact was not working.
No.
He needed to find an out pitch. So he's going to... Speedmeister, go in the lab, find a sweeper, maybe work on a splitter. I know that's all the rage. And we'll see if you can come back better next year and
prevent Speedmeister to drive line
from hitting 101 home runs. Anyway, that's my Paw Patrol recap. I encourage like half of it is available on YouTube, but it cuts off kind of at a key point. So if you could go find it, if you subscribe to whatever the channel is that shows on. All right. That was great. Great podcast. Jake, big weekend ahead. Mariners are in St. Louis for the first time since 2013. Twins and Royals, Guardians, Dodgers. You're just going to be parked on the couch just watching ball this weekend, right?
Yeah, that's the plan.
All right.
Me and 200 of my friends.
Looking forward to it. Well, I am about to get on a plane to fly to the Reagan, to Washington, D.C. area, where I am going to... I have a reservation at a hotel in D.C. Cool. And I'm just going to kind of hang out and watch baseball.
Nats
and
then aren't we'll see home, if any... though, dude.
Oh, the Nats aren't home, but that's fine. I'm just going to sit in my hotel room and just watch baseball for the next, I think, 48 hours. And then, if anything, we'll see what else comes up. You know, I'm not going to... We'll see what else, you know, happens this weekend.
Yeah, I'm getting married.
Okay, Jake's getting married. Yeah.
If the... One of my bigger rules for the wedding is no baseball analogies. Like, I have had nightmares about people being like, Jake really hit a home run with her. Like... Okay. So cut that from your
damn,
speech.
Damn, I got to edit my whole speech now. It's just only baseball analogies. Okay, good to know. Thank you. Looking forward to it, obviously. I will see you tonight, assuming my flight is smooth. And it'll be a fun weekend. And most importantly, there will be no podcast on Monday. Sorry, friends.
Sorry.
That's that. But thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. And we will talk to you on Wednesday. Or I will talk to you on Wednesday. Jake will be married and busy.
Justice for Speed, my friend. I am up.